there are those mysterious classics that you can hear again and again and still swoon, such as George and Ira Gershwin's groundbreaking Porgy and Bess. Earlier this year, the playwright Susan Laurie Parks told me about the first time she saw Porgy and Bess. She was in second grade, it was 1970, and she caught the Porgy and Bess movie on television.
I vaguely remember like one of those scenes from childhood. It was like the late, 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 late show. And 5 minutes of it, and I just was like, oh, I don't think so. Fish are jumping, and the cotton is high. It looked like one of those movies where they didn't quite get to know us like I knew us. It had a certain, things that make your head pull back, and it smells funny, yeah. Even through the TV.
Yeah, so, and you've not seen a stage performance.
No, okay. No. But I knew all the songs. That's the thing.
Right.
I knew all the songs. I mean,
one does.
We used to sing them around the house. Me and my mom used to sing Summertime around the house. Ella Fitzgerald was the one me and my mom and dad listened to.
Oh, your daddy's rich and your mom is good looking.
Flash forward a few decades, and Susan Laurie Parks is a Pulitzer Prize-winning MacArthur Genius playwright. The estates of George and Ira Gershwin come calling. They want a new version of Porgy and Bess, the 75-year-old opera, that can work on Broadway in 2012. So Parks has turned some of the lyrics into dialogue, fleshed out the characters, put in new backstories, but it remains the tale of a crippled man, Porgy, who falls in love with the town tramp, Bess, played by Audra McDonald.
So hush, little baby, don't you cry.
Even before the show opened, some traditionalists went berserk. Stephen Sondheim wrote a long, angry letter to the New York Times. One of the things that most bothered him was that the new version from Susan Laurie Parks is called The Gershwin's Porgy and Bess.
It's as if the Gershwin estate has a brownstone. They invited me to do some work on their brownstone. It's their brownstone.
And they want to call it The Gershwin's.
It's their brownstone.
Yeah.
They can call it, whatever they want. I mean, it is their property.
Yeah.
They invited us to work on it. And end of conversation. I mean, really?
Yeah. So what did you think, you and your director think, okay, what is missing here to translate it to an audience in 2012
right,
in the Broadway
right,
stage?
Right.
What was your first sense of, here's what we have to do?
My first sense, right away, it was very clear that these people who are singing these songs of love and passion and, triumph and failure and all these incredibly powerful songs, that they deserve a story that is equal to it. And the book had, which is brilliantly written. I mean, first of all, Du Bois and Dorothy Hayward wrote the play based on Mr. Hayward's novel. Right. So Mr. Hayward initially wrote the novel called Porgy. He and his wife adapted it into a play, and then they went on to write the libretto. Brilliantly, beautifully, very beautifully written. Dramaturgically, there are some holes that have nothing to do with any of the politically correct buttons that people think,
that it was white people portraying black people in this certain way.
I find it just, if they were, that there were some just dramaturgically, there's some holes in it.
Like what?
Well, for example, when they sing that beautiful song, Bess, You Is My Woman Now, that beautiful love duet.
Bess, you is my woman now and forever. This life is just begun.
And then moments later, Bess goes to the picnic. And, oh, I don't know. But when I, if I were to sing, you know, a love song to my sweetheart, and then he, 2 minutes later he's going to a picnic, I would need a reason why I'm not going with him. And so we just added a bridge to that. And it's a bridge not just to fill in a gap, but to provide Porgy and Bess, and the whole community actually, with a really strong story arc. So Porgy has a reason why he stays behind.
Which is to say he's getting a brace.
Yes, he says, I'm staying behind and getting a new brace and a cane. You know, yeah. So while she's off on Kittawa,
I bought that.
Well, yeah, it's just a little bridge, you know, that it strengthens his quest to secure her love, you know. So all the characters now, all the main characters, have a really strong story arc.
I want to play a clip. This is David Alan Greer playing Sportin' Life, the tempting devil of the piece.
Woo! Look at that sport life! Dressed to the nines for Saturday night!
Looking good ain't no crime.
No, but the way you play craps sure is.
Oh, nobody knows when the Lord is gonna call. Roll him on the road, roll. It may be in the summertime, it may be in the fall. Roll him on the road.
Sportin' Life has always been one of the both comic relief and more entertaining characters in this show. Did you feel like you had to do much work with his character and his story?
There are questions that I had and others had about Sportin' Life from the very beginning. Is he from that community or not? Is he, you know, so what's his relationship to those folks? And then just sort of enjoying the sort of how real Sportin' Life is and how he speaks to, you know, the sort of pimp culture of today, mm-hmm. you know. I mean, it's still set in 1930s, but the pimp culture of today and just how much, just saying it's okay for him to be kind of a snaky guy, you know. He's a snake. He's a pimp. He's a drug dealer, after all. He's not a simply, you know, song and dance kind
right.
of guy. He's an unsavory character.
And did you?
Who is incredibly charming,
yes.
just like a pimp,
a successful pimp,
right? Exactly.
And did you emphasize the things like the happy dust, the drugs, and his pimpiness and blinginess to make it more resonant?
I don't think so. I just sort of made, you know, it's okay for Sportin' Life to be an unsavory character,
right? Rather than just the fun guy.
The fun guy, yeah. He's the guy everyone wants to be around, but not because he's always a barrel of laughs, you know.
Now, George and Ira Gershwin, white people,
yes.
the authors of the novel and book,
yes.
white people.
Yes.
And partly, I suppose, as a result of that, from its first production through the 60s and 70s
right.
and beyond, it's been,
ooh,
this problematic. What are these white people describing the poor black culture? If you can remove just the political baggage that attends to that at different moments in history, did they get something wrong?
Well, let's just say to remove the political baggage, I think the thing is, it actually can't be removed from political baggage because we're in America and you just can't take out, you know what I mean?
Right.
I mean, we know, so, but let's just say if I were Susan Lurie Parks, me, and living in New York City in 1936, wanting to write about maybe Jewish folks on the Lower East Side.
That would have been interesting.
Well, exactly. And I would have written maybe an opera or a play or a poem even. It would have been from my point of view. Now, I'm an outsider to that community. I mean, here I am, an African-American woman, an outsider to that community, an African-American woman, and here we are. And do I have access like someone who is of the more of the community? So there is a somewhat of a distance that happens. And when there's a distance that happens, there's things that are missed. There are things that are misunderstood. It's not a crime. I think
it's not racist.
Exactly, to my mind. Now, there are scholars and folks and people, black, white, and other, and the multitude of people who might say it's racist. For me, personally, I had to work on it. And for me, saying, calling something racist, you know, that's a room that,
it's a certain. There are things that are racist, but it seems as many epithets like that are too easily defaulted to as an explanation for everything.
Well, there are things in the world.
In the world.
Yes, there are things in the world that are racist. And I think that for me, entering into the room of the Gershwin's Porgy and Bess, I saw it differently. I think that what's unfortunate about a lot of people, they hear Susan Lurie Parks is working on it, or they hear a black woman is working on it.
They're trying to whitewash it, shall we say.
Yeah, or she must be finding, she'll find it racist, and then she'll have to fix, you know, all these political.
Right.
And me, I'm sitting here as a Pulitzer Prize winning, MacArthur Genius Grant winning writer. I look at it as, yes, as a black woman, but also as a writer.
You won the Pulitzer Prize for a very innovative piece of theater. You are an often called an experimental theater person. You've also worked a lot in showbiz. Doing a television movie for Oprah Winfrey, writing screenplays for Brad Pitt, and you're Miss Hollywood as well. did Ray Charles musical that I want to see?
Oh, yeah.
Were you bringing to some in some way that's kind of mass accessible pop sensibility to this piece of work?
What did I bring? I mean, it sounds corny, but, you know, I brought love. It's like, I mean, that's the thing. They say that love has no color and love has no, you know, it's like you just bring like, wow, I love this music. I love these people. I love what this can be. And you fill it with that. So you're not trying to make it experimental or pop or anything. You're just trying to get the strongest story for these people so it will really go hand in glove with the beautiful music and just tell the story in the best possible way. When I sit down and work on it, I'm not thinking it has to be for Broadway. I'm not thinking, I mean, how many seats are in the Richard Rodgers Theater? Maybe over 1,000. I don't know. The lots of seats. I'm not thinking, oh, no, I better write this line because if I don't, then we'll lose 500 seats or something. I'm not thinking that at all.
Back in a few years ago, you wrote a play a day, a little play every day for a year.
Yes.
365 of them.
Yes.
They were produced all over the country.
All over the world,
All over the world.
Sorry,
Which always struck me, as soon as I heard about it then, as an amazing stunt if one had agreed to do it, I could see about 3 months in going, what have I done to myself? But I wondered, did it change the way you work? I mean, just doing that for a year, has it changed your work subsequently?
That was the thing that I wrote after Top Dog Underdog. And people were expecting me, write the next Broadway thing. And we were everywhere but Broadway. We were in Myanmar. And it was just a process of waking up every day and going, what do I see? And what do I want to show? So it made the process of writing very modest, I guess you could say. So I'm more modest in my... I can't explain it.
All I have to do is what I have to do today, I guess.
Yeah. And just be generous and kind and loving and share. That's all.
In addition to being generous and loving and kind, you've started performing more.
Yes.
And you perform as Sula Parks.
Yes. Oh, where are you? You know everything about me now.
Pretty much. And there's more to come. Who is that? Let me meet her.
She has a guitar, and I sing and play. And I just thought it would be fun to have another personality.
Sing me a bar or two.
I'll sing you. This is from Bronze Star, and it's I wrote it for my dad, who was a Vietnam veteran.
And a lieutenant colonel.
And came home with a Bronze Star. So the guitar part is really cool, but you just have to imagine that I'm playing a cool guitar part. So it goes, my daddy, he came home with a big Bronze Star, and he bought himself this two-seater car. It was a triumph. For all he won for us, he said, it was a miracle. Mama said he didn't come back. Flag draped and dead. So it goes on from there.
Susan Lurie Parks, thank you very much.
Thank you. It was fun being here.
The Gershwin's Porgy and Bess won 2 Tony Awards last month, and the production is still running on Broadway.